on. As I was about to say, it's sort of a daunting task between 20 people and their gourmet pizza. And in particular, to talk about regions that contain 10 times the amount of stars as the previous three talks. So this is a bit of an ambitious talk. I'll try to get it done in 30 minutes. If I see someone gnawing through the video cable, I'll get the message. We're going to move on, so beyond Taurus, beyond a nearest 400 parsecs, and go to the more massive star-forming regions. And with the guaranteed time that that we received for Spitzer as part of the IRAC instrument team, we surveyed a number of objects out to about 1 kiloparsec. And this is actually a very interesting regime because it contains the clouds that are forming massive stars, and not just massive stars, but loads and loads of low-mass stars. So these may be more representative star-forming regions for our galaxy. And I'm going to concentrate on this talk on two regions. There's Orion, a distance of 414 parsecs, and there's Cepheus OB3, which is a distance of 712 parsecs. These are actually from Maser parallaxes, so these are fairly accurate numbers. So just to give someone, to give all of you some perspective, this is sort of a map of star-forming regions looking down onto the galactic plane. So we have the heliocentric model here with the sun in the center, and these are distances in parsecs. And basically, the C2D and the Gould's Belt and the Taurus surveys, the Spitzer have all concentrated on this inner region, about the inner 300 parsecs. But once you get out beyond that, you get all these massive star-forming regions. You have the Orion clouds, you have the Monar 2, the 2264s, the SEP OB3s, and all kinds of clusters. And this is a map, at least about a year or two old, but I think it's pretty much up to date, of all the regions that have been surveyed with Spitzer. The blue circles are the molecular cloud surveys, so those can cover entire molecular clouds of certain AV, and then the red dots are cluster surveys. So those are usually ones that cover sort of a 15 arc minute region surrounding a specific cluster. And it's hard to say how many of the known clusters and groups. I think we're complete to about 90% within a kiloparsec. Of course, that's the operative word there is known. So we actually have a fairly good sample, and we're trying to get as many of the larger molecular clouds as we can because these are very interesting objects that I will now hopefully convince everyone of. So I don't know if we're going back to Monday. Everyone kept talking about three questions. And so I said, instead of answering other people's three questions, I'll ask my own three questions, and then try to answer. And these are them. First one is, what are the demographics of star formation? This is the eternal problem of, do stars form in clusters or in isolation or in what proportion in each? And so I'll address that. The next one is, does environment matter? Do we really care? Does a star care? I mean, we care whether stars form in clusters or isolation, but does a star really care? Does it make a difference to the star what kind of environment that it forms in? And then the final question is, what is a cluster anyhow? We talk about clusters, but they're actually not quite as distinct and clearly defined objects as we think they are. And as I just sort of mentioned before, I'm going to focus on massive star-forming regions, partially because they pretty much produce stars of all masses, not just high-mass stars. They contain a variety of environments, and they're probably the most prodigious producers of stars in the galaxy. And so we also need these for comparison with other galaxies. And then, of course, our own sun, which we all love, formed in a massive star-forming region. So these are all good reasons. Why Spitzer? Now, what I'm going to focus on is really talking about spatial distributions. We've been talking about column densities, and we've been talking about temperatures and stuff. But what Spitzer is really good at, as Debbie showed, is for identifying stars and classifying sources, not for really finding masses or stellar masses or core masses. And so we're really going to start just studying the distribution of these identified objects in the sky. And as I hope to convince everyone, this is a very useful thing to do. So here is a picture of the Orion survey made with Spitzer. Okay, here the Orion constellation is shown there. I love looking at this because then I can actually look into the sky and sort of visualize where my maps are made. The blue areas are basically all the areas that we mapped with Spitzer. It follows the distribution of the molecular clouds. And in the red, I actually show the 12CO map from Wilson et al. Showing the distribution of the molecular clouds. Here's the Orion B cloud. Here's the Orion A cloud. The Orion Nebula is right there. And the green dots are all the young stellar objects that we identified through their infrared excesses toward this cloud. And so we have around 2,260 in the whole survey. The total number of sources is around 90,000 that are detected at 3.6 and 4.5, but most of those are just background stars. So first I'm going to give a sort of visual tour of the molecular clouds just to show, sort of show you. This is just of the Orion cloud. In fact, I'm just going to show one part, and that's the Orion A cloud right here. And I'm going to sort of follow this hockey stick shaped map. I'm going to start sort of from the shaft of the hockey stick and work down to the blade. Okay, so now we start at the very end. This is the most distant part from the Orion Nebula. And here we see, in all the maps I show here, we have a combination with red at 8 microns, green is 4.5 microns, and blue is at 3.6 microns. So this is all, the red stuff is all the beautiful hydrocarbon emissions that we see. You can see there's young stars here, there's nebulosity, there's outflow jets, all kinds of stuff, a little reflection nebula. And now we use the magic infrared excesses to find all the young stars that have disks or envelopes. And there they are. So we can go pop through them. So you can see there's, again, stars that are in little groups. There's a lot of them are very spread out. This is a parsec. So these guys here are actually fairly isolated as far as we can tell. And then there's things that are more group-like over here. Okay. And now we move up the cloud a little bit, and you can see we're getting closer to the Orion Nebula. Things are getting brighter and more active. And we go identify all the infrared excess sources, and boom. And you notice things are starting to get more sort of concentrated in little groups. We have 1641C here, L1641 North, and V380 and such. And then you can see something is happening up here to the north. I've sort of rotated it, and now I'll show the Orion Nebula sort of unceremoniously turned on its side, just so we can show the whole thing. Here's the main part of the Orion Nebula. Here's a several parsec loop that extends from it. This is the region OMC23, where you can actually see the molecular filaments and absorption. And then this is another region called NGC 1977, which is basically heated and ionized by this B1 star there. And this gives you a distance of one parsec. And then if I take the infrared excess sources that we find there, you see that they're very concentrated here. They sort of follow filamentary structure, and I'll talk a little bit more later. They also tend to sort of fill into this bubble over here, which I think is sort of interesting. And so there's this, there's a, the main cluster here, there's the OMC23 part here with lots of protostars, and then there's sort of a secondary cluster here.
What are the ones with blue?
Well, those in my initial identification, those were protostars. I've actually enhanced my method of finding protostars, so I wasn't going to mention those. That's fine. Okay, so now let's go from showing pictures to actually showing distributions of infrared excess sources on the sky. And so here are actually the results of two of the most active star-forming clouds within a kiloparsec. And one is the Cepheus OB3, and one is the Orion A cloud. And I call them active because they contain two of the largest clusters. There's a cluster here of about 1,000 young stellar objects, and then there's a Orion Nebula cluster here with about 1,000 objects. These distances here are in tens of parsecs, just to give you the scale. The white things, that shows you all the point sources we detected. The contours are the AV maps. I think it's AV of 4 and AV of 3. And then the green dots are all the infrared excess sources. And so when you look at this, you can see, well, there's clusters, and then there's isolated stars. But the clusters are certainly not isolated objects. Right? You go from the center of the Orion Nebula cluster all the way down to the tip of 1641A, and you see all these groups and more groupy things and more distributed things, but it's almost this continuous lane of star formation that goes all the way down here.
Can I just ask where you've done about galaxies?
We have a system of getting rid of galaxies based on the color and also the luminosities to get rid of the AGNs. And this is actually also described in a paper by Rob Gudermuth. So we do go through a lot of gymnastics to try to get rid of that. If we estimate by taking surveys of empty regions of skies, the extragalactic surveys, and then running these through our source identification, that there's probably, I think, a few objects per square degree. And these are, so there's on the order of maybe tens of AGNs and galaxies that go through these filters. So it's pretty well filtered out. But there could be, there is always the issue that a few of these sources, and it's a very small number, could be galaxies, just very bright ones.
Now, if you try to separate these into older and younger, they all have disks, but some of them might be platforms which are faster to try to separate.
I'll talk about that in a moment. Yeah, yeah.
Looking at the distribution in Orion A, mm-hmm. It seems to be asymmetric. At least most of the stars are aligned to the left.
Yeah, yeah.
The density gradient? Because you only plot the AV and the lowest contour. Right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, it was getting confusing. Yeah, it actually does turn out that the highest AV gas is concentrated up here. So it is a density. So the cloud sort of has this nice dense filament along here, and which is sort of an interesting fact. And then it gets lower density over here.
What's the argument that that's a filament and say not a Hadron shell or something?
Oh, well, that's just a matter of religion there, I think. If you ask Jeff Hester, it is a shell, and it's all being triggered. So, and that's not a bad idea. Actually, I think I'll show some images later which say that it's actually could be part of a shell. And I think that would be a good explanation of what's initiating the star formation in this region. But, okay, one more.
Uh-huh. I agree that they are not completely clustered, as you still point out, but this is in the spatial position. Mm-hmm. So if we imagine we could have information on the proper motion, mm-hmm. and so on, mm-hmm. we are just capturing them in some particular time in their evolution. Maybe proper motion would indicate that they would be coming together. Or
multiple parts. Yeah, that would be interesting. And I'll show you some velocity information a little bit later that we got with radial velocities measured with the Hechtel-Schell spectrometer. The pizzas don't arrive in advance. So one of the issues, let me just go back to this point, is that the clusters are not really isolated entities. It's really hard, particularly in Orion A, to pick out clusters. And so at some point, mainly because people like Fred Adams and stuff kept bothering me about how many stars were in cluster and how many stars were in distributions, I finally had to sort of decide on sort of a definition. And remember, this is a definition. It's not really a solid physical argument. And the reason is that when I look at, if I take all the sources in these maps, and then I plot the nearest neighbor distribution, so this is the distance to the nearest YSO, not just the random star, the nearest YSO, I get this distribution. So there's a lot of stars that are very close to another YSO, and there's a lot of stars that are actually fairly distant to a number of YSOs. And there's sort of this continuous distribution. And it's a little bit arbitrary exactly where you would cut off. Is this these stars in clusters and then these stars in distributions? And then there's a sort of the same thing with the density. I sort of take the star and I calculate sort of a local density by just finding the distance to the ninth nearest neighbor, and then calculating a density by taking 10 divided by pi r squared, where r is that distance. And I get this distribution of number versus the density. So this is the high density area, this is the low density area, and so these we might call clustered and these we might call distributed, but there's no real distinct break in this distribution. Although we may, in some more recent work, might have found something that could actually establish a break. But from these plots, there's no clear break. Now, so at some point, you just have to sort of decide what's clustered and what's isolation. And so I took basically two facts. First, that humans have evolved to have 10 fingers. And the second one is that the sun is 1 AU from that the Earth is 1 AU from the sun. And when you take those together, you get a number 10 stars per parsec squared. Okay. And so anything that's at a higher density I call clustered, and anything that's sort of a lower density is distributed. The other thing actually also relies on the number 10, is that you have to have 10 objects sort of together to have a cluster. And so what I did is I actually, this is one approach, but there's different approaches. I took the path linkage criteria, where you basically assemble friends of friends, where each friend has to be within the distance of 0.33 parsecs, which is, again, related to the 10. And then collections of 10 or more friends are considered groups or clusters. And then the collections of less than 10 friends are the distributed stars. That doesn't mean they're completely alone or isolated, but they just don't have enough friends, basically. And I, that's right. And so here I basically colored the different groups and clustered. So here's the Orion Nebula cluster. Notice it contains this whole area right here. And then here's some more groups and clusters down here. And then the green ones are the distributed stars, the ones without friends. And then the same thing with the Cepheus OB3. Here's the big cluster again with about 1,000 stars. This is Cepheus A, for those of you who know the Cepheus region. A few more groups here, and then there's a lot of more distributed stars. Okay. Now, part of the reason I did this is I want to understand the demographics. And so now you can start plotting, you can sort of, again, define sort of arbitrary bins and start plotting the fraction of stars in different sort of environments, in this sort of the distributed environment where there's less than 10 friends, the groups, which are 10 to 30 friends, the small clusters, which are 30 to 100 friends, and then the large clusters, which are more than 100 friends. And these are only counting infrared excess sources. And there's also, as I'll show later, there's issues with completeness and stuff. And so these are very sort of crude. But one of the really great things that Spitzer can do, which we're not capable of doing before, is we can detect the isolated stars. And so these distributed stars are very hard to detect if you're just looking at the density of objects in the sky, which is what people had done with the near-infrared surveys. But now we can actually see that in all of these regions, particularly these high-mass regions like the Monar 2 cloud, Acepo B3, and the Orion, there's large numbers of stars that are relatively distributed. They're not part of large clusters. And in fact, in some of these, it seems to be approaching 40, and Monar 2, maybe even almost 50%. Okay, so there's a lot of very distributed stars. And then when you take into account that these regions have 2,000 stars or more, you have basically two toruses of relatively distributed stars in each one of these regions. Right? So they're not just, these massive star-forming clouds are not just, they don't form all their stars in clusters. There's a range of environments, and there's a lot of stars that are forming pretty much sort of on their own in areas that are not very crowded and don't have very strong UV radiation. And that's...
When you say they're forming on their own, say right now they're on
there. Right, right.
Are you going to talk about that?
A little bit. Yeah, that's actually a good point to make. And actually, these, I should not say forming on their own. They're found in their own. They're found in isolation. Now, this is the distribution of protostars. And to identify the protostars reliably, I've relied on the 24-micron data. And unfortunately, it's saturated right in the middle of the Orion Nebula Cluster and also in NGC 2024. And we could recover protostars in those areas, but with less reliability. And so this is what I'm sort of concentrated on now. And so here's basically about 303 protostars that I've isolated using one of my techniques, color techniques, and you see them distributed throughout these entire clouds. And then here's the distribution of the remaining young stellar objects. Now, even though they look fairly distributed, you can actually associate about 73% of these with the existing groups and clusters in there. For example, all these things up here, even though they look fairly isolated, a lot of them get actually put into the Orion Nebula cluster. Oh, I was just trying to avoid definitions here. Basically, it's anything with a slope greater than alpha of a minus 0.3. And so it includes all flat spectrum and protostellar sources by the traditional. And I basically measured the color. What I did is basically measure the 4.4 to 24 color, which gives you sort of a slope from 4.5 to 24 microns. And I took the ones of those that would be considered flat or rising. And then I threw out all the really faint things because those were almost certainly galaxies. And so there was also some filtering for extragalactic objects. And then I also looked at the slope between 3.6 and 4.5 if I had a 3.6 detection, and I made sure that was also rising or flat so I could throw out transitional disks, which actually can be rising at some of the others. And so that's basically how I did that. So these are things that, in most cases, except in the case where you might have an edge-on source, and I think those are rare, that you pretty much need an envelope to reproduce the SED. There are a few that may just be due to reddening and a few that may be due to inclination, but I think most of these really have to have envelopes. So anything with an envelope, I don't care if it's class 1 or flat or class 0, gets lumped into these.
Okay. So I would say that in our experience, only half of the flats have envelopes. So do you have any idea if the distribution is different for the flat things than like the class 1 if you take alpha root of 0.3 or something?
It's fairly random, actually. Yeah, I have to go back. I haven't done that in a while. But I when I look at the characteristics of the flats and the class ones, I don't see a huge difference in anything, really. So I think, and there aren't actually, I'm trying to remember the fraction of flats. It's not as quite as a hyper fraction. But the flats are mixed into that. In this.
Okay. Did you try to see what the velocity of the individual sources and if that could change the clustering properties?
I'll go into that in a moment, actually. The best attempt I could do with 1 to 24 micron data. So I just wanted to point out that even though the protostars are very extended, a lot of these you can also see beautiful reflection nebula and stuff. I mean, this is, and they are extended throughout these entire clouds, and they're also often found in these filamentary configurations. You see a filament there. Up here is the OMC23. Here you can, well, it depends, you can be imaginative and say they are not. Here's another one, beautiful one down, LBS23. And they all seem to, a lot of them seem to be sort of aligned with the overall axis of the cloud. So that's interesting.
You're just saying the stars follow the extinction.
They tend to follow the extinction, yeah, in some level, yeah. I mean, it's a little bit more than that, but I agree. It sort of follows the extinction, and extinction is in filaments.
And do you have any chance to extend the areas that the objects are there?
I'm sorry?
Do you have any chance to extend the area that you have surveyed? Because clearly you cut off...
Yeah. Yeah, we are trying. We have a little bit more GTO time to do that, and we've extended a little bit. But to do the whole area right would require a large amount of time. So what I'm hoping is that there will be a warm mission for Spitzer, and we can do this whole area in 3.6 and 4.5 microns, which would actually be enough to do a lot of this work. So there are some prospects for doing that, but this is what we could do with the available time. So it's about 7 square degrees. Any more questions on this? I've actually forgotten the point of this slide now.
earlier this week, we heard, I guess, what Melissa mentioned also, that there seemed to be a threshold in AB for sort of stars. So now that you've just spoken on this sample, did you find any such threshold?
I have to look at that. The problem is that the AV map for Orion is not particularly good at the moment because you have a lot of contamination with sources inside the cloud. So I haven't really felt so confident of the AV map to really want to do that yet. But it's something on my list. Actually, what's going to help this is the UKID survey. We're going to get very deep JH&K data for the Orion, and that'll make this doable. But I, 2 mass just isn't quite enough. Okay, well, so the next, go on to the next question is, does environment affect protostars? And so taking my definition of protostars, where I just lumped everything together, and then I just basically did nearest neighbor distances. And I did the nearest neighbor distance from protostar to protostar, and then also protostar to the nearest YSO, where it could be any type of YSO. And so here, these are distances in astronomical units. And what I always find interesting when you do these, the peaks are always very small. These things are often, the peak of the distributions are about 10,000 AU. Okay, and the median distances are about it's about 30,000 AU for protostar to protostar, and about 20,000 AU for protostars to the YSOs. So the protostars are typically in very densely grouped and clustered locations. Not always, but in many cases. And when you consider that if you want to build just a half a solar, you know, half a solar mass protostar, and you have sort of a surrounding density of 1 to the 10 to the 5th per centimeters cubed, you need to sort of sweep out material or pull in material from about 5,000 AU. All right, so it's almost getting to the point that these guys, you know, if they're together, that their envelopes have to be sort of touching. And so there's many that are also, if you take the genes length, I mean, it obviously varies from position to position, but it's about 20,000 AU. So these distances are not so different than the genes length, given all the uncertainties. And so I think the point here is that protostars, in many cases, are very close to each other and to other YSOs, and that their envelopes could be touching. This also brings up the possibility of collisions between protostars. And so there is chances that being in a crowded environment can actually affect protostars through collisions, through competitions, through cooperative accretion. If you take Eric Kito's idea, through all these different ideas, that they may have these interactive effects. Now, one thing is actually, can you see any evidence for this? And this is, I put direct evidence in quotes, sort of following Alyssa's example. And so here I've taken what Thomas asked for, the luminosity, but I've only integrated the luminosity to 1 to 24 microns, right? And that's because I don't really have longer wavelength data. And so this is only really a fraction of the total protostellar luminosity. But it's the best I can do. And then I plot that luminosity for all the sources as a function of the nearest neighbor distance to another YSO, and then also the local density of sources. And you do find that the ones that tend to have higher luminosities, at least in these bands, tend to be in areas that are more crowded. They have closer neighbors, and they just tend to be in areas with higher nearest neighbor densities. And if you actually go through the statistics, you find that it's a very low, even you also see lower luminosity sources in areas with high densities. And if you actually, what you really need to do is you actually need to look at the distribution of luminosities both in areas where there's a lot of crowding and in areas where there's very little crowding. And when you do that, you find that these distributions are very different. Because of this excess here of the high luminosity sources, the chances that these things, that these objects here and these objects here on either side of that white line are drawn from the same apparent luminosity luminosity function are very small from the KS test. It's about 10 to the minus 5th. There's a little bit of issues with completeness here, but overall, that's the at least the first order result.
Question, Tom.
Yeah?
If you go back to the histogram of the mm-hmm. Do those peaks arise essentially entirely from the regions which you would call clusters? Or do they also have significant contribution from smaller, less than 10, which are
They do come from, in L1641, there's a lot of sort of smaller-ish group of 4 or 5, maybe 10 objects. And I haven't gone through this in sort of a case-by-case basis. They're not all into really big clusters with 100. But I think most of these are in sort of smallish clusters, at least with 10 or 30 stars.
If you had tried to do this before, would you
have seen it? Good question. Well, I think one advantage is we can identify the protostars more effectively. I don't know. I have to go look at that. That's an interesting question. There's certain things like these protostars here are fairly spread out, even though they look very close together here. This is over a region of several parsecs in a fairly large region of the sky. So when you draw these kind of maps, it's sort of it's a little bit deceptive. But you see that most of them, there's a group here, there's a group here. There's these that are part of the Orion Nebula cluster. And so probably most of them do fall in groups or clusters. Okay. All right. So this is basically what I was getting in my one question is, does environment affect the protostars? And I guess that sort of the first order answer is that there's evidence for that, but you also have to worry a little bit about sort of just chicken and egg problems. In other words, are these somehow more luminous because of some effect due to the crowding, or is it just that these things are forming in areas with higher column densities or different gas properties, and these lead to the more luminosity? So regions that have, say, higher column densities not only form more luminous objects, but they form more objects. And so this doesn't necessarily imply that it's the interactions between the neighboring protostars which cause the high luminosity. There are other explanations. And in fact, when I do the same analysis, I find that regions with higher column density seem to form more luminous objects. And so there's maybe multiple interpretations of this particular effect. Okay. But there is something there to be studied. Now the next question I wanted to go at is what are clusters? Okay, what is a cluster anyhow? And so first I'm actually going to sort of steal some resources, some clusters from the C2D survey. These are actually from GTO observations, but they're part of the C2D clouds, the Serpens main cluster, and NGC 1333. And I plotted here, so they're about equal in spatial distance to half a parsec. On the left are the pre-main sequence stars, and on the right are the protostars. Okay, and so the blues are the flat spectrums, the green are the ones with the rising spectrums. Here you can see the class 3s from X-rays, and the greens are actually the class 2s from disks. And then on the red, we should actually show the SCUBA map, so you can see where the submillimeter sources are. And there's interesting things about this is first that you get sort of such a diversity of configurations. For example, here in NGC 1333, the protostars are actually sort of spread out, and they sort of fall along in these sort of filaments that like this. On the other hand, Serpens, you see these really close groups of protostars, in a particular disk group here where the objects are just like about basically a few thousand AU apart. And then on 1333, you look at the class 2s and the class 3s, they don't actually look that much different in their overall distribution than the class 1s. And they're a little bit more spread out, they're a lot more numerous, but you don't see them show such a strong difference. And that's actually sort of surprising, because if you just sort of took a velocity of a kilometer per second, these guys would be moving about basically a parsec per million years. And so this was basically these clusters are so surprising that these clusters look so dynamically unevolved, at least in the case of NGC 1333. On the other hand, in Serpens, you do see a very distinct difference. You see the protostars here in the center, and you see the sort of the class 2 objects much more spread out. And so this is sort of just to demonstrate there's a wide range of sort of characteristics for clusters, and it's not clear that they're all the same thing. I mean, you obviously sort of a grouping of objects. The other thing that's interesting in 1333 is that there's really no strong central condensation. In Serpens, there's a bit of a central condensation with the protostars, well, not with the class 2s, but in 1333, there is no really distinct central condensation. There's also a very steep drop-off in the density as you move away from the cluster, which is interesting. And then the other thing to note is that they're also elongated. Now, 1333 is elongated along this direction, and Serpens is elongated along this direction. And so this is just sort of like a little Spitzer mini seminar on sort of the spatial characteristics of clusters. And so one of the things that we've done is try to sort of statistically study the different configurations for a large number of clusters. And so this is now going from just not just the Orion and the Cepheus data, but from a total sample of 65 groups and clusters that we studied. And this is really the work of Rob Gudermuth, who's pushed this ahead almost single-handedly. And one of the problems when we study spatial structures is actually coming up with statistics, right? You need some sort of statistical method to actually sort of characterize the structure. And one of the things that I showed here is that the clusters tend to be sort of elongated. And we saw this also when we looked at the ONC cluster, for example. And so one of the statistics is something called the AAP, which is the azimuthal asymmetry parameter, which basically measures azimuthally sort of the asymmetry, how elongated the cluster is. In other words, you basically took a centroid, you calculate the number of stars in different azimuthal bands, you get a diagram like this, and if it's flat, it's basically circularly symmetric. If you see these wavy patterns, it's very strongly, it's very elongated, or azimuthally unsymmetric. And now you plot this parameter of the asymmetry versus the number of YSOs, and you get this plot here. The one thing to also note is that as you get down to the smaller number of YSOs, the statistic is basically less effective. But you find that a lot of the clusters actually seem to show very high elongation, and in particular the large clusters, this is the Orion Nebula cluster and the SEPO B3 cluster, are extremely highly elongated. And so the clusters, I think the point of this is that clusters are not sort of circularly symmetric, typically, or centrally condensed clusters. They don't look like open clusters. They don't look like globular clusters. These embedded clusters are some things that have very sort of irregular, non-relaxed looking shapes. And here's just to show you what I had done before. Again, this does not look like a circularly symmetric, relaxed group. This certainly doesn't. There's two sort of big clumps here. None of these things do. They're all very irregularly shaped objects. Now, this is maybe not so surprising, because if you actually calculated what relaxation time you would need, it's probably much longer than what we expect for the lifetime of a cluster. And that... I'm not going to go into some great detail, but the typical time for what we think that it takes to basically disperse the gas in a cluster is on the order of a few million years. And so here we take a plot where we show the number of YSOs versus the cluster radius. Here's our same cluster sample. Here's the ONC, Cepheus OB3. And these are basically the relaxation times that you calculate. And if you actually, this is without the gas. Ignore this. I forgot to change this. If you actually add the gas, it slows down the relaxation a bit. And so it would take many, many millions of years for these clusters to relax, at least on the largest scales. And that time scale is basically longer than it takes for it to get rid of the gas, which in most cases is going to disrupt the cluster because the gas is the larger portion of the binding mass. And the other thing to remember is that while there is gas, these things are sort of continuously forming stars. They don't tend to stop. They just keep forming stars until all the gas is dispersed. And so you have a configuration where you have this very sort of elongated, non-relaxed configurations. You have very long relaxation times. You have star formation happening concurrently. You have gas dispersion happening concurrently. And so these clusters never basically relax into circular, spherical, nice sort of open clusterish type objects. Okay, and so that's basically my take on that. And so clusters basically reflect, in great part, their sort of formation configuration. Now, to sort of show this in more detail, we can take a look at the Orion Nebula cluster. I'm probably way over time.
Yes, sir.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, he's up there.
All right, we're about two ways.
He's right back there, Alice.
Back there.
Okay.
So here's again the same picture image of the Orion Nebula cluster. You can see again it's not very spherically symmetric. You see these stars, these strong filaments here. You see the cluster here. You see these things that are blown out in this bubble. This is basically the radial velocities for the optically visible stars in the Orion Nebula cluster. And this is actually work by Gabor Firas, who took the Hechtoschell spectrometer on an MMT, and he took all the infrared excess sources that we could see in the optical and measured their radial velocity. So here it is from 15 to 35. This is about minus 6 degrees to minus 4, so it basically covers this area to this area. The bigger the dot, the higher the more accurate the measurement. There's a more higher the signal to noise. Basically, the actual accuracy of the velocity depends on the signal to noise for a particular star. And then in the background here, we actually plot the distribution of the gas. So this is basically a position velocity plot from the 13CO map from the Bell Lab survey. And you see that the stars follow very nicely over this region the velocity of the gas. And so there's particularly right around the Orion Nebula cluster, there's this nice kink in the gas velocity here, and that the young stars sort of follow that same kink. And so that's interesting. So that also doesn't really look like a very sort of relaxed structure. There's also these stars out here that seem to have these sort of discrepant velocities. Gabor has basically found that they tend to be right here. And what we think is happening is that as the cluster blew out these clouds, so there's basically a ring of molecular gas, although it's not very dense anymore, they were forming stars. And as the things sort of accelerated away because of the rocket effect, they sort of left the stars behind, and they ended up filling out this bubble. And some of these stars seem to have sort of leftover velocities from this expansion. Sure.
So the velocity dispersion in the blue stuff, which I was out of the gas, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Looks smaller than in the star. Is that just my eye?
It may, well, there's the thing that I haven't, I know the question, it's not exactly clear because you have to worry about the actual uncertainties in the gas measurements are larger. Or the uncertainties in the stellar velocities are larger than the uncertainties in the gas velocities. And the uncertainties in the stellar velocities depend on the brightness of the star. And so I think the stellar dispersion is a bit broader, particularly here. You can see these objects, which are high confidence. But it's hard to tell from this graph exactly what the... He gets a sigma of about 3.1 kilometers per second, and I was just looking at that. But I think that includes the whole gamut here, right? And there's multiple components. There's these that follow the cloud. There's this stuff here, which may be associated with the bubble. And then there's also these what are probably a foreground association stars. And so it's a really good question, and I don't know why I don't know the answer of that. But we'll have to ask Gabor. So, but any other questions about this? Okay. Now, just one of the biases of doing the Spitzer measurements is that it's very hard to measure, detect objects in areas of very bright infrared luminosity. And that really, in some sense, limits our detection. And particularly that's true right in the center of the Orion Nebula cluster. And so here is the one of the ways you might be able to patch this up a little bit is to look at the COOP data, because the X-ray data is not really affected by background. So if you remember, the COOP survey is basically a very deep X-ray survey of the Orion Nebula. So here is basically a map of the Orion Nebula cluster. The red is the AV map from two mass. The greens, all the usual dots. These are young stellar objects. These are the protostars. And in blue here, I put the COOP survey. So you sort of see the extent of it. So it doesn't cover what I would call the whole Orion Nebula cluster, but it covers the densest part in the area that we're least complete in. And it does make the cluster look much more centrally condensed. And there's actually several hundred objects in the center. And I'm trying to figure out right now exactly how many, which are not actually detected in the Spitzer data. So it is a bias in all this work that I'm doing, that I'm working to get out. Now, one interesting thing about the Orion Nebula cluster is you go back one more minute. Okay, let me. I have two slides. Okay, I'm sorry. I told you it was ambitious. Well, is that if you just take the density of stars, the number of stars as a function of their local density, you get these sort of plots. These are different parts of the Orion cloud. Here's Orion B. Here's the Orion A, 1641, and here's the Orion Nebula cluster. And you see that suddenly this distribution, which typically falls, suddenly levels out. And if you add the COOP, and even if you just have the Spitzer data, it sort of flattens out. And so this is basically the central condensation. Because this one cluster is really centrally condensed, instead of getting this usual distribution here, where the number of stars falls with increasing density, you get this thing that sort of flattens out. And so the Orion Nebula cluster is interesting because it's one of the clusters that we see that is extremely centrally condensed. And so here's sort of like the, I just wanted to put out this idea, which is probably stupid or obvious or obviously stupid, but I wanted to do a little bit of theory, and since, you know, most theorists leave out magnetic fields or turbulence, I figured as an observer I could also leave out gas pressure and just sort of... consider what's happening here in the Orion Nebula cluster. So this is a section of the Orion Nebula cluster taken with Spitzer. Here are the filaments up in OMTC3, and these things are forming little protostars that fall along these filaments, just like peas in a pod right along here. And then things get a little bit more disturbed, and then you get the Orion Nebula here, which is just a complete mess. And so I sort of thought of this model, just say that this whole thing is sort of in the form of free fall, everything toward a gravitational center, which is right here. And you think of these things as sort of individual, each thing is like a little sort of protostar that's in free fall, and then this whole thing is in free fall to the common center. And obviously, if this thing was just a giant sphere, all of these objects would fall to the center in the same amount of time. It would take one of the individual spheres to collapse, right? This is sort of the general free fall for sort of a homogeneous medium. But they aren't really in a sphere. They're sort of more in this extended configuration. And so you might think that out here, up here, because these things are so far away, that before this gas could, if this gas is collapsing in toward the center cluster, before these things could actually collapse into the center cluster, the local objects would collapse. And so up here, basically local collapse dominates over global collapse. But then once you get down into the center of the Orion Nebula cluster, basically global collapse or global velocities become more important. And basically, not that everything falls to a certain point at a certain time, but you just basically get this churning mess of protostars. And so that might be just sort of one view of how you distinguish star formation. There might be sort of different modes of star formation. Not mode is the right word. Within the Orion Nebula cluster itself, where an area's local collapse dominates, and in other areas, more global sort of collapse dominates. And this is just to sort of show the whole range, but I'm going to stop showing that. And I'm just going to leave this. You can read this with your pizza. But it's sort of like 5 points, 6 points that... that I wanted to go over, and obviously needed an hour instead of 40 minutes. I apologize. Enjoy your pizza.
That's much to digest, but
I was trying to keep it down to 1 point.